Hello and welcome to The Menu, Monocle Radio's food and drink programme. I'm your host, Chiara Rimella. This week, we're getting bookish with an episode that's dedicated to food and literature about food. Coming up, we sit down with food writer Felicity Cloak to hear her take on what makes great gastronomic prose.
Thinking about texture, about the way it sounds, the way it feels in the mouth, it smells, you know, all the stuff around it as well, is I think the thing that brings food to life.
Also on the programme, we delve into James Bond novels to find out how important food and drinks are to the plot. Shaken, not stirred, anyone?
He insisted on eating seasonal produce, sampled the local cuisine wherever he found himself, and had a deep distaste for processed and frozen food.
Plus, we whip up a recipe from Nora Ephron's acclaimed book, Heartburn. All that here on The Menu on Monocle Radio. Cookbooks may occupy plenty of bookshop shelves, but some of the most enduring writing about food actually hides in the pages of novels, memoirs, or travelogues. Be it a description of a fictional feast or a snapshot of a place as seen through its most representative dishes, food is a fundamental component in a writer's attempt at setting the scene. From Proust's Madeleines to the plums that were in the icebox, it can also become about so much more than a description of taste. Felicity Cloak has published both recipes and travel books that revolve around eating and drinking, and she knows a thing or two about what makes a culinary account so memorable that it lingers both in the mind and on the palate. I sat down with her in the studio to find out about her favourite food-laden pages and what's next on her writing list. Felicity, thank you so much for joining me in the studio today. It's a very exciting topic and one that I'm very passionate about as both someone who loves books and loves food. The combination of the two tends to really, really hit the spot for me. But I think there's like a specific tradition and a specificity to writing about food and food in writing. I wonder what your take on it is. Why do you think that we're so obsessed with writing about food and writing food into books?
I think there are a couple of reasons. The most obvious is because most of us are very greedy. And so, you know, you can see it also in the popularity of food TV, food on film. People just really, if they're not eating, they like to be sort of vicariously eating. And so I think that we just find that very enjoyable. But also, and this applies as much to sort of food scenes that aren't enjoyable, sort of depictions of terrible food or times of famine, it's a really easy way to ground you in a narrative because, you know, we all have to eat. It's something that we all relate to and it's a sort of everyday detail. But, it, you know, there are lots of things that we all do, lots of very bodily things that you don't necessarily want to be reading about, whereas eating is very easy to describe, very colourful, and just you can instantly see if you describe someone's daily diet, then it instantly sort of positions themselves in terms of background, class, wealth, all of those things. So I think it serves a couple of useful purposes, but I think probably the main one is pleasure.
Yeah, I mean, and food is about that mostly anyway, I think. You've written both cookbooks that are more instructive and instructional, and you're very precise when it comes to your kind of cookbooks. And then you've written travelogues that are laced with food throughout. What led you to writing both kinds of books, and where do you find your most natural way of writing about food comes out?
I'm pleased that you said that my recipes are precise because that makes me very happy because I'm by nature not a very precise person, but I do think that recipes are one time that you need to be quite specific about things, otherwise they go wrong. I say that from personal experience, but I think, again, it comes from greed for me, for both. I've always been very greedy both for books and for food. I've always enjoyed eating and I was such a bookworm as a child. I was that kid that always had a, you know, a book in their school blazer pocket. I, you know, always had my head in a book. And so I think the two married quite nicely and I knew that I wanted to write from quite a young age, but I didn't realise that you could write about food in that way because growing up, the books that we had that dealt with food were all cookbooks and they were things like Delia Smith and Mrs. Beaton and like the Nouvelle Cuisine of the 1970s and 80s. And they didn't really have any writing in them beyond the recipe. So they were quite instructional manuals. And I remember the first time I saw a Nigel Slater book and it was just a revelation because the writing in it was beautiful. You could read it like you know, like a novel almost. And he made food seem very exciting and sexy. And then a bit later, Elizabeth David's collected essays, they were just wonderful and witty and just so, so evocative at the time she was writing. And I found that really exciting. So when I left university, I thought that's what I want to do. But to be honest, I never dreamt that I was actually going to be able to do it. So for me, the writing probably came first. And then when I realised that I could write about food, that was just a dream come true.
It's funny, when I think about my favourite food scenes in literature, I have a tendency to refer to Proust's Madeleines, like, very, very frequently as just a manner of speech that I just use in my normal conversation. But then weirdly, and it's interesting that you mentioned about descriptions of food that are not so nice, one of the first descriptions that came to mind is Ulysses by James Joyce. I mean, not because I want to show off that I have read Ulysses. I've not read the whole thing. I skipped through a lot of it. I've got to be honest here.
Yeah, it's more than most people.
But there's this description of Harold Bloom making kidneys, and they're a bit disgusting and awfully, and it says that they have this whiff of urine, and it's kind of weird and yet mesmerising. It's funny how not always do descriptions of food need to be mouth-watering to be memorable.
And you make me think there of a more recent book, The Vegetarian, by the South Korean author, I think it's Han Kang, but I might have remembered that wrong. And it's quite a short book, but it's just got such visceral, in the very real sense, descriptions of preparing meat and food. And it's just astonishing. And I remember reading it on the tube and just feeling a bit like, I don't know, like I was dripping blood as I was reading it. It really is, it can be quite intense as a sensation. And I think because we've all got experience of that, of maybe going into a butcher's shop and slightly, you know, recoiling or thinking, I didn't realise this was going to be awful or whatever. And so you're right that food doesn't always need to entice us to be very powerful. And in a slightly lighter way, someone like Nigel Slater writing about the food of the 1960s and 70s in the UK, it's such a good way to bring the reader into that apparently very grey and depressing time in this country. Just needs to, say the words Findus Crispy Pancakes, and people that remember it are just immediately back there.
Well, you've written about national identity through food as well. And I wonder how you think national identity, your personal identity, are all wrapped up in one through food, and how fundamental food is as an instrument to look back at history.
I think that one of the interesting things about food is, as I say, it's universal, so it's a good way into a culture, whether that's a different sort of geographical culture or historical culture, because it's very few things that are easy to relate to about, say, medieval Spain. But the idea of, why so much pork is used, for example, or things, we can think, oh, that sounds, why did they do that? Why on earth is it so pork focused? And then you learn, and this is post-medieval, but you learn that actually there's so much pork in traditional Spanish cooking because of the Moorish influence. When they'd left, it was sort of proving to the Inquisition that you weren't a Muslim, and so you put pork in everything, even dishes that previously hadn't had pork, and you just stick it in. And I just find that really interesting, and it's a way to think, maybe all these people didn't want to be eating that much pork, maybe some of them were just revolted by it, but they were like, okay, gotta do it or I might be burned at the stake. So I think it's very relatable. And what I like about it from a travel point of view, and when I travel and I write about the experience, it really, even the grumpiest person that you meet en route, whether you're in northern Scotland or the south of France, some people just don't want to chat for whatever reason. And then you ask them about food and they just open up. And I'm not saying they're suddenly like, hey, come to my house, come for tea. But they will say, oh, that's where you can get the best breakfast. Or, this is the good boulangerie or whatever. It's just a little way into their everyday life. It's a moment of connection that I find very interesting. And you can tell a lot about a culture and its history by the things that it treasures. And I think that's particularly interesting in countries that were quite quick to industrialise, like the UK, because we think we don't really have a historic food culture. We do, and it's so fascinating how even people like me who, we know how to cook and good food and good ingredients, but the nostalgia for me of, beans on toast, like really industrial food, is quite strong. And I think, if I'm really miserable, that is what I want. It's not some sort of Irish stew, it's beans on toast.
I think it's really interesting how, I'm Italian, and Italians spend all of their time just thinking about food and talking about food incessantly. If you walk down the street, it's very likely that if you overhear somebody on the phone, it will be talking about what they're going to have for dinner, what they're going to have tomorrow for lunch, what they should go to the grocers to pick up, or commenting on a meal from the night before. It's really quite astonishing. I wonder how much our obsession with talking about food, which we are doing right now, which is talking about the idea of food, and even that is enticing in itself. But I wonder how writing about food, reading about food, talking about food influences our enjoyment of the thing itself. If you've read about a recipe, if you've read about a certain type of food in a novel about a place and then you go there, do you think that changes the taste when it hits your mouth?
It's a difficult one because in some ways you want to experience a new food or a new food culture completely unmediated by other people's experience and account of it. In another way, it's really helpful to know what the things are that are special to look out for. And I remember one of the things, Fuchsia Dunlop, the British food writer who writes a lot about Chinese and particularly Sichuan cuisine, her memoir, I think it's called Shark's Fin and Sichuan Pepper, she writes about how when she'd lived in, I think it was Chengdu, for a while, she started to realise that she'd really absorbed the food culture because she started to prize texture as much as taste. And that's not something that we do a lot in Western Europe, really. We're sort of, there's a few things, like particularly very crispy things that we enjoy for their texture. But mostly we're a bit like, oh, you know, it's a weird jelly texture or a weird slippery texture and that puts us off. Whereas, as Fuchsia says, in Chinese food particularly, it's very prized. And she said, you know, my parents were over and I was ordering a hot pot and saying, oh, we have to have these slippery intestines or whatever it was. And that just made me enjoy suddenly things like tofu in a whole different way, because I realised the thing with tofu is, in general, it's not the taste for most varieties that is the point, it's the texture. And suddenly I was like, oh, that's what that's about. So it can be very helpful to your enjoyment to know what you should be looking for. Which is not the point of writing about food. It's not like a guidebook, but it can sort of open things up to you. And it does, you know, I'd love to know what's special about a place. And that's, for me, the best travel writing has got some sort of food. And the travel writer Jan Morris, who died quite recently, I think her writing was great, but it's so, for me, a bit dry just because it lacks the food. And she once said of Sybil Bedford that she was always writing about, you know, pointless, silly things like food. And I thought, that's why I love Sybil Bedford. You know, she's always motoring off to go and have a martini somewhere and some sort of crab pasta with a fisherman. And I was like, that is what, you know, for me, I travel to eat mainly. And I want to know what someone's had for dinner. You know, that's very evocative for me. And for me, a place is not complete without its cuisine. It's such a huge part of a culture and a people.
In your memoir, what would the dishes that punctuate your life be?
Golly, well, definitely there'd be a lot of buttered toast, because I was at boarding school and I retained a fondness. We used to eat so much toast. I think I once ate 7 slices of buttered white toast at break time one day. It wasn't breakfast, this was just break time. So there'd be a lot of that. And growing up, we ate, I guess it was the 80s, so we ate quite a lot of, like, my mum is a French teacher and a real francophile. We used to eat a lot of, you know, ratatouille and things like that. And it was never, we didn't really do the Finder's crispy pancake thing. So it'd probably be a lot of stuff involving like aubergines and courgettes and stuff that all my school friends were like, oh my God, it's got garlic in. And I probably discovered traditional British and Irish food, because my granny's Irish. I probably didn't discover that so much until my 20s and I came to London and suddenly it was very trendy. And, you know, I remember going to St. John and just having my mind blown by this really simple food, quite sort of meaty and like just a couple of things on a plate. So that was really exciting to me. But yeah, I think toast would be my signature dish. It'd always be toast. I just absolutely love it.
I want to ask you a very kind of writerly question that is about your craft. When you sit down to write about food, what happens inside of you? What kind of words do you reach for? I find as a writer that when I write about food, I have to almost unlock another part of my brain where you need to make an extra effort not to be literal, because writing about food isn't about writing about taste. Does that happen to you as well? When you sit down and you have to write a book about food, what happens in your brain?
For me, the struggle is not reaching for the most obvious thing. And because I consume so much sort of food writing, it's very easy just to think about how, say, a steak or some fries, or staying on an American bent, are usually described. And that's probably not how your experience of them was, because everyone's palate is different. And, you know, what I love about food is it conjures up so many associations that are not just about the food. So I try and take a step back and just think, a little bit like with wine tasting, what is it that I'm really experiencing here? What does this take me back to? What does this look like? And, you know, go beyond the crispy fries or the meltingly tender meat and just think, ha, you know, what is this doing for me? What descriptors are the ones that pop first into my brain? And just trying really hard not to be original, but to be true to my own experience. And often that goes quite a long way beyond the taste and the looks, which is usually how we write about food. And again, thinking about texture, about the way it sounds, the way it feels in the mouth, it smells, you know, all the stuff around it as well, is I think the thing that brings food to life. Because yeah, everyone's read a million descriptions of, say, chocolate cakes, but, you know, the way to make it new to someone is to describe your own experience of it. And that can be, it can be quite surprisingly difficult, especially when you're writing about food all the time, to present a new description that's going to make people see it anew through your eyes, as opposed to, you know, the million other descriptions they've read. So yeah, it can be a bit challenging to avoid the cliches.
Well, what about what you're going to be writing next? Is there a kind of a biographical streak that we can continue unraveling, or is there going to be you hitting the road somewhere else and cycling through another country and eating your way through it?
Well, there is going to be another there's going to be another travel log, and it's going to be an interesting one because I'm going to the United States, which I find really exciting as a food culture, because a bit like the UK, people don't think about it as a place of good food, but there's actually some incredible food, such variety. I mean, obviously it's a whole, you know, North America and just the US is basically a, you know, a continent on its own. And I'm really excited to find what's beyond the big chains and the things that we see that they export around the world, what real American food is, and to just chat to people. Slightly nervous about cycling around, but I don't think I'm going to lose any weight. Put it that way.
Felicity Cloak there, in conversation with me, Amidori House. This is The Menu. Sometimes in books, food is so integral to the storyline that it becomes a character in itself. In the case of James Bond, you know who the protagonist is, but have you ever stopped to consider how revealing what he eats and sips on whilst he's on his missions actually is? His creator, Ian Fleming, was particularly interested in using his suave secret agent to explore culinary delights around the world. Monocle's Charlotte MacDonald Gibson, a lifelong Bond fan, reflects on how food and drink helped build the character and the world of 007.
We all know that James Bond liked his martinis shaken, not stirred. But if one were to ask about his favourite jam, his most loved dish, and what specific type of hen he liked to have laid his morning eggs, chances are the average 007 movie fan would be flummoxed. But anyone who has read Ian Fleming's Bond novels knows that the food, fine dining, and of course astonishing amounts of alcohol imbibed are essential ingredients in a heady mix of sex, snobbery and spying that make the book such a unique read. In many ways, James Bond, as written by Fleming, was the prototype foodie. He insisted on eating seasonal produce, sampled the local cuisine wherever he found himself, and had a deep distaste for processed and frozen food. In Jamaica, in Live and Let Die, Bond feasts on the first black crabs of the season, a little suckling pig, avocado pear salad, guavas and coconut cream. Breakfast in Turkey, in From Russia with Love, is yogurt in a blue china bowl, deep yellow and with the consistency of thick cream. The green figs, ready peeled, were bursting with ripeness, and the Turkish coffee was jet black and with the burned taste that showed it had been freshly ground. In France, it's foie gras and Lyon sausage. In Japan, Kobe beef and blowfish sashimi. Back in the UK, Bond will only touch asparagus in season, and his smoked salmon must be from the best Highland curers. While these sumptuous descriptions are essential to building both Bond's world of wealth and luxury and the character's almost superhuman suaveness, they also encapsulate one of the reasons why Fleming's novels were so successful when they came out. Britain was emerging from the Second World War, and Bond's creator was determined to give the depressed post-war readers some escapism from their daily grind. Fleming demonstrates a prowess with the cuisines of the world, which would have appeared unimaginably glamorous in the drab Britain of the 1950s, when even bananas were considered exotic. Some newly arrived items even flummoxed Fleming. Avocado was so mysterious and exotic that he has 007 eat it as a dessert. Food was also a crucial element in Bond's countless romantic entanglements. He treats his Bond girls to long, languorous meals. It's soon after caviar, lamb chops and asparagus with mousseline sauce at the 21 Club in New York that Bond tells beautiful gem smuggler Tiffany Case in Diamonds Are Forever that his ideal woman can make sauce béarnaise as well as love. He woos Vesper Lynd in Casino Royale with caviar and beef tornados, washed down with copious champagne, confiding in her that I take a ridiculous pleasure in what I eat and drink. And of course, he creates a famous cocktail in her name, the Vespa.
3 measures of Gordon's, 1 of vodka, 1/2 measure of quinoa lily, shake it over rice and then add a thin slice of lemon peel.
Yes, sir.
You know, I'll have one of those.
Indeed, alcoholic drinks in the Bond canon are afforded as much attention as the fine foods. Fleming ensures his hero drinks like a local wherever he is. He quaffs copious amounts of eau de vie across France. Sake is served at exacting temperatures in Japan. In Italy, he sups Negronis, and when stateside, he ensures his old fashions are served with the correct bourbon. And while he is scathing about both beer and tea, when it comes to his firm culinary favourites, Bond has some surprising home comforts. To answer my original questions, Bond likes French Moran hens to lay the eggs his Scottish housekeeper serves for breakfast in his Chelsea flat. His favourite jam is Tiptree Little Scarlet Strawberry Jam. And breakfast is Bond's favourite meal of the day and is frequently described in luscious detail. A particular favourite is scrambled eggs, which are quite bizarrely eaten at all hours of the day. Bond even gives his readers a calorific recipe in the short story 007 in New York. 3 eggs, 6 ounces of butter, fine herbs, and served, naturally, with pink champagne, Tattinger, and low music. So I say cheers to that, Mr. Bond. I think it's time to live and let dine.
Charlotte MacDonald Gibson there with that report. You're listening to The Menu. Now it's time for the week's top food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Tamsin Howard.
This week, Michelin stars have been awarded to a record 52 French restaurants for the first time in the 115th edition of the Michelin Guide. This includes 23 that only opened in the last 12 months. Over half of the laureates awarded 1 or more Michelin stars are under the age of 40, with director Gwendol Poulenec announcing that French gastronomy is no longer stuck in the past. Head chef of Copenhagen's Alchemist, Rasmus Munk, has announced plans for a stratospheric dining experience in 2025. It will see 6 guests take off from Florida in a carbon-neutral space balloon by spaceflight experience company Space Perspective. Munk has teamed up with Space VIP to provide luxury service to the diners on board the 6-hour flight, which starts at $495,000 per ticket. And the winner of the Cullen Skink World Championships has been crowned. Professional chefs and amateurs competed on Sunday with their take on the traditional Scottish soup, which is primarily made with smoked haddock, milk, potato and onion. Kelly Spooner of the Aberla Hotel won both the traditional contest and with a twist contest, with her addition of black pudding and capers. Those are the week's food and drink headlines. Now back to Kiara.
Thanks, Tamsin. You're listening to The Menu. Food punctuates our lives, and writers know this very well. The taste and smell of something we've eaten can take us back to the places and people that surrounded us, which is why, in literature, it can be shorthand for memories and feelings from the past. In the late Nora Ephron's novel Heartburn, recipes are used as a tool of recollection and are sprinkled like sugar throughout the novel. Published in 1983, the book is a thinly disguised Romana Clef and is said to document an extremely difficult time in the author's life. Divorce, affairs, pregnancy, it's all there, and to accompany it, recipes, which highlight the book's emotional moments, emphasising them at one point and obscuring them at the next, much like in real life. And whilst Efron lamented that she was never a food writer, there have been dozens of tributes and imitations of her gastronomic prose, proving that recipes can be just as influential in novels as they are in cookbooks. Here, this programme's producer, Monica Lillis, cooks Efron's version of Linguini alla Cecca.
So, linguine alla cecca is a hot pasta with a cold tomato and basil sauce. And as Miss Efron put it, it's so light and delicate that it's almost like eating a salad. She also says in her novel that it's really better to make this during the summer months when the tomatoes are at their best. But to be honest, I was a little bit too scared to try her very 1980s adjacent pot roast. So we're going with an easy weeknight dinner. In terms of ingredients, it's really quite basic. All you need is 5 large and ripe tomatoes, 50 grams of fresh basil leaves, some good quality olive oil, a clove of garlic, some chili flakes, and a generous pinch of sea salt and black pepper. And of course, some lovely dried linguine. So we've got everything out here in our kitchen. Let's get into it. Pop the kettle on to boil to speed up the process. And while we do that, let's fill up a bowl of cold water and slice across into the base of each tomato. Once we've done that, the water should be boiling, so we can drop the tomatoes in and leave them to cook for around 1 minute. A minute's up now, so scoop the tomatoes out and pop them into that bowl of cold water. Leave the water on the boil though, because we'll need that for the pasta shortly. Now it's time for the pasta. Pop that on, 10 to 12 minutes ideally, depending on what it says on the packet. Whilst that's bubbling away, we can turn our attention back to those fresh tomatoes. Peel the skins off them, cut them open and scoop the seeds out and the core. Roughly chop them and pop them back into a different bowl. Add your basil leaves, garlic clove, olive oil and a nice pinch of salt and pepper. And of course, a dash of chili flakes, if you like it spicy. Mix that together with your hands, if you're brave enough. Once the pasta is cooked al dente, you can then drain it and add it to your cold sauce. Toss it all together, and you must serve immediately. At least that's what Nora Ephron writes. The result is an acidic and delicious pasta dish, the perfect dinner, and it'll get you in the mood to reread Heartburn just one more time.
And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday in San Francisco. Also, don't forget to tune into our spin-off show, Food Neighbourhoods, for a tour of some of the world's tastiest destinations. I am Chiara Rimella. This programme was produced by Monica Lillis, and our sound engineers were Mariella Bevan and Tamsin Howard. Thanks for listening, and until next week.